There are many contrasts in this letter of Paul to the Colossians that we're studying Sunday night by Sunday night. We're into the rather practical section at the moment, and so tonight we look at Colossians chapter 3, verse 20 and 21. Have a look at it in the Bible that you've got with you, I hope. I'm not too sure of the number of the page, but somebody can perhaps just quietly tell me when they find it. For those who are beginners with the Bible, somebody tell me the page number we're on. 189. It's good to look it up, good to have it in front of you, good to get to know our way around the Bible and to feel our way around, even if we have to look in the index first of all to check where Hebrews is. Otherwise you find it's in the old, you think it might be in the Old Testament, and it isn't, and things like that. This is Colossians, and we're looking at Colossians chapter 3, verse 20 and 21, children and parents. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. I think it was Andrew Corns who, in planning this series with his friends last autumn, chose this one for me. Because I'm a family man and I'm supposed to know all about it. Oh, I know all about it. I do. And it is a privilege to try and give this address. And I hope with some degree of application to the lives of every one of us here in church. We're in the field of relationships in this practical section of Paul's letter. Wives and husbands, verse 18 and 19. Children and parents, verse 20 and 21. Servants and masters, verse 22. My brother Michael was once in a train. He's a clergyman. He's a businessman, I should say. And traveling along, he noticed that the man opposite him, fairly elderly, was looking at him very intently. And presently the man spoke up and he said, "Is your name Bewes? It must be." My brother said, "It is. But had we met before?" The man said, "No, we've never met before, but," he said, "I recognized you by your nose." He said, "I know the Baisley nose that comes up every now and again in your family." And he said, "I saw it unmistakably in you, the family likeness." You know, as we look at today's study on children and parents, we're probably aware that so much of what we are and have derives from our parents. It happens physically, genetically, intellectually, emotionally, in many different ways. Not that any of us are a straight cocktail mix of our parents. Each of us have a kind of overplus element of our own, with the capacity to assert ourselves and to establish our own identity. And this is what makes the child-parent relationship so incredibly fascinating and so amazingly complex. When you beget a child, you beget another unique individual, another personality. You beget another will. So when a new arrival is pitched into this world, into a family, immediately there begins a process of self-assertion. Look at me. I'm here. Listen, I've arrived. And so teddies get flung out of prams and shoes get posted into the milk jug and all sorts of fascinating things happen. We should never be surprised. And we shouldn't be over-worried. You see, you can always take bounce out of a person. It's not so easy to put it in. Having said that, we have to recognize that living and growing is a long and sometimes very painful education. And education itself is a matter of discovering and establishing your relationship to the universe. That starts in the small universe of a caricot. The classroom then broadens out into that of a home, a family and parents who one's got to get along with, brothers and sisters and so on. Here is God's natural unit, the family. And that perhaps is the first thing that I could say about this child-parent relationship, the obedience on the child's part and the respect and the restraint on the parent's part. Here it is. One, We learn this biblical lesson foundationally from creation. It's built into our order, the child-parent thing, the relationship that's there. Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 15 shows us that every family finds its pattern in God Himself and His fatherhood. It stems from that. The whole of the story of the Old Testament is the story of a family. Children are brought up to obey their parents as parents, who in turn are to love them and care for their children. It's pre-Christian. It's a creation ordinance. So we get the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother. We learn this foundationally from creation. Why this relationship? It's because parents form a vital point of contact with life. They are the initial reference point for everything that keeps us alive. Food and clothes and gripe water, nappies and pocket money and security, everything. Parents form the link with life. They also form the point of contact with the past. People like to know about their origins. Americans come swarming over to this country to discover about their ancestors. It's important to them. Yes, and in addition, parents ideally form the point of contact with God. To begin with, they stand in the place of God. A child knows the laws of its parents before it ever knows the laws of God. They're like God to him, to begin with. And if we lose this link with life and with the past and with God, disorientation sets in very easily. I think of a young man who was convicted of burglary. He'd done 13 houses, one after the other. Ours was the 13th. He was caught, and then investigations took place. Did he need the cash? Not really. He'd never known who his father was. No one bothered to tell him. Various men came in and out of his house. They were all called uncle. Here was a person who'd lost his moorings. Consequently, he went berserk in his own personality. It is for parents, however imperfectly, to give to their children the vital lessons and standards for life. Without that, society begins to come apart. Down the road at Piccadilly Circus, our statue of Eros reminds us of the great Earl of Shaftesbury. He once said this, "Education without instruction in moral and spiritual principles will merely produce a race of clever devils." And so Paul sees this relationship in a specifically Christian context. The parallel passage, Ephesians 6, verse 1, has an extra phrase, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord." That's the context that Paul sees it in. That's the factor that makes the difference. True, Christianity doesn't reduce us by our obedience to parents. No, it doesn't do that. Maybe when we were younger, we thought it did. Obey my parents, it makes me shrink as an individual. But that's not so. We may not always believe it, but the parent-child relationship is actually given to enhance life and give it security and to make sense of life. So that parenthood at its best has the stamp of God the Father upon it. We learn this lesson foundationally from creation. Secondly, we learn it realistically from the Bible. It's such a refreshment to battered parents to read the biblical account of God's families. You see, you may, if you're a parent sitting in church or listening to the recording of this message, you may say, "Oh, I'm such a failure. You've no idea of all the damage I must have done my children through misunderstanding, through all of my misjudgments. I've failed." And we beat ourselves sometimes over the head with horror stories, and we torment ourselves with dreadful examples of what we've heard in life. There was a boy of 9 at a school in Middlesex, and it was from the headmaster's wife that I gathered this little gem. He wrote an essay at his school on my future career. This was his essay. When I leave school, I shall probably go on to St. Paul's Public School, or the City of London, or King's College, Wimbledon. After that, I hope to go to the university. After that, I will buy myself a house, a car, and furniture. I will probably get married, although at present I have doubts about it. And here are his reasons. Because Mummy spends half her time telling Daddy off for such things as buying the wrong beer, waking up the baby, and not keeping promises. And if this is the outcome of the wedding, spelt weeding, if this is the outcome of the wedding, it isn't worth the salmon and a 3-story cake. Now, I don't know what's happened to that little boy of 9. You see, perhaps we're right to challenge ourselves with examples of this kind. And yet, because of the overplus factor in our personalities and lives that makes us the unique individuals that we are, a person can indeed rise above the disadvantages of a bad home and a bad upbringing and bad and inadequate parents. And many listening to me now probably are in this very position. Perhaps your parents weren't particularly caring or good. Or perhaps they got muddle-headed over some things. They just didn't know, as I feel myself to be on numerous occasions. And maybe you did get damaged, somebody here. And yet here you are now. And I dare say that you're a Christian. I dare say that you're making progress. The grace of God compensates. Indeed, it does more than compensates. The grace of God comes in and wins and transforms and helps and lifts. It's come into your life. The cross of Jesus Christ has swept the burden of accumulated guilt out of your life. And Christ has taken over the very, very center. If that's happened, that's a wonderful thing. We may look back to a difficult upbringing or a difficult childhood, but God's grace can do so much. This happens despite the mismanagement and the abysmal failure that many parents do feel themselves to be. It happened in the Bible. Let's be realistic. How did God ever use those families that we read about in the Old Testament? Noah comes out of the ark after that great triumph of faith. He's a champion of faith and obedience. And the sign of the rainbow is given to him in Genesis 9 and verse 17. Then 3 verses later on, what do we read? There's Noah in an alcoholic coma, blind drunk. 2 of his sons are shocked and they get a blanket to cover his indecency. How did Noah ever scrape his way into the great 11th chapter of the letter to the Hebrews with its honor roll of the great men of faith? He's there. On that record in Genesis 9, I wouldn't easily put in such a bad parent, but God put him in. The Bible is realistic about its families. Jacob was a bad father. He indulged the youngest in the family. He made him his favorite. He broke all the rules. But there he is in Hebrews 11, his place carved out there for all posterity. A man who won his way through faith. Eli was a useless father. He didn't help his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, at all. He only indulged them, as did David with Absalom, his son, who led him a terrible dance. But there's David, safely got his parking place in Hebrews 11, verse 32. Now, of course, we don't take our examples of good parenthood from these individuals. We probably look more in the direction of Timothy in the New Testament, Tiny Tim, with his godly mother and his saintly grandmother. 2 Timothy 1, verse 5 reminds us about this. And very often you do find that wonderful line of faith running through a family. When it happens, it's wonderful. But if the Bible is realistic about its very imperfect families, we can be too. Let's not build for ourselves a kind of Madame Tussauds waxwork image set of a glowing, united, harmonious, trouble-free, ideal Christian family. Some Christian paperbacks hold up for us what is really a cardboard cutout of a Christian family, surrounded by a pink haze of unreal wholesomeness. Those families aren't really around. And life in a family is not a picnic. It's a tremendous blessing to have Christian parents. I don't think I could have had a better, more ideal upbringing myself, there on the slopes of Mount Kenya, in a lovely climate, surrounded by warm, loving people, in an atmosphere of Christianity. It was very tranquil. It's a great blessing to have that, and I was fortunate enough to have it. But that in itself guarantees nothing. We know that deep down. It guarantees nothing. If you and I choose to go away from the Christian faith, it is ultimately we who choose to do so. And we can do it, even if we had a flirtation with Christianity. I give you an example. It's a solemn one. The spy Donald MacLean died recently in Soviet Russia. We were sad when we heard that, because it seemed, from what the newspaper accounts were, that he died in loneliness and not happy. That makes us sad. My father knew Donald MacLean. That's the extraordinary thing. And when I shared with my father the other day, we were together, we were looking at the newspaper, then he showed me his photograph album about 1925, the CSSM in Southwold. That stands for Children's Special Service Mission. And he said, there's the picture, he said, I took. There was a group of about seven people. In the middle of it was young, bright-eyed Donald MacLean. On his right was a man called Quintin Carr, who became prominent in Christian circles in this country. On his left was a young boy called Herbert Taylor, who is with us today as an outstanding Christian man in his retirement. He's been a clergyman. Behind Donald MacLean was a man called Clarence Foster, who became prominent in the great Keswick Convention that we have in the north of England every year. And Dad took the photograph. Dad was leading the mission. And Donald MacLean's father wanted him to go to the mission, encouraged him to go. So he went. And everybody called young Donald, they called him Sir Donald, because of his father, Sir Donald MacLean, who wanted him to go. We don't know, of course, how he was in his later days. He was in Soviet Russia. The indications are that he wasn't in a happy state, and that he died lonely. We sometimes say that we can blame our parentage, or we can blame environment or our upbringing. No, we can't do that. We may have a flirtation. We get many chances. But each of us in the end makes up our own mind which way I'm going to go. Don't ever blame your parents, even if they were perhaps very muddle-headed. God has no grandchildren, it's been said. He only has children. We can't inherit our life in Jesus Christ. We have to make our own decision. Each comes to terms with God for themselves. What do we read here? Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. We learn this foundationally from creation. We learn it realistically from the Bible and from all those imperfect families that nevertheless God is able to touch and use. Maybe that gets the balance. But I have a third point. We learn this painfully from experience. It is painful being a child of one's parents, however good the parents. Shall I tell you why? It's because we're in a stage of transition and education all the time. So we can't stay still. We're moving. We're experimenting. We're trying out. We're pushing out. Children, obey your parents. The word for children here is not the word used in the Greek New Testament for little children or for babies in arms, but simply the word we would use to describe the son or a daughter of whatever age. While our parents are alive, we are always their children. And yet at each stage, we live in a different relationship. And all the time, we're moving, or we should be moving and adjusting to the next stage. That can be painful. We shouldn't be surprised at that. We move from complete dependence to almost total independence during the course of our lives. Yes, we're to be obedient to our parents, and yet in subtle ways, the relationship changes. The obedience issue modifies as we get older, as we form our own opinions, as we go our own way, as we make up our minds. And it's less obey your parents and more honor your parents the older we get. But there will be some here who have faced the pain and grief of a straight choice between Christ and parents, usually resulting from parental pressure to reject Christ and his rule. How many instances I've known. It's common. Some are called to face the radical and even revolutionary implications of New Testament Christianity when the point comes to a straight choice between Christ and one's parents for the sake of truth. It's even happened, I'm sure, for some of my listeners, that the Church of God has had to become your family. And we long so much that this family of all souls will take you up and love and cherish you and encourage you within the great bond of Jesus Christ. For Christ taught, Luke 14, verse 26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, etc., he cannot be my disciple. This is not an English concept of hatred. It's the Semitic hatred, in which one loyalty is simply put before another. In a straight choice, one loyalty has to defer to the other. That's what it means here. And so if it has happened to some people here, for the truth's sake, it was very painful. One recognizes that. And perhaps that's why we have Paul's qualifying phrase in the parallel passage of Ephesians 6:1, children, obey your parents in the Lord. Yes, one does respect and obey one's parents unless and until their demands cut clean across our allegiance to Christ. Then a difference comes in. And there's pain, too, if we face emotional blackmail from parents, possessive parents, possessive perhaps of children who are now married and they find it difficult to let them go. They find they can't throw away the leash, can't understand that others now will be influencing their lives. Or even from an early stage, as they go to their first school, other influences, other pressures, other tutors are there already. Some parents can't bear it. And for parents, there is the pain of losing possession, of realizing that children can only be accepted as a privileged trust from God. There is pain, even in the best and happiest appearing families. Let's accept that that can happen. There's the pain of familiarity within a family, of knowing all the little idiosyncrasies, all the habits, all the little failings, all the little conceits and irritations of one another, simply because we live in a fallen world, and all our failings will be seen at their most prominent in the place where we are most ourselves, at home. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. There's a good balance here. There are mutual responsibilities that we try and learn little by little. Sometimes society gets the balance a bit wrong and pain results. Some parents here may still be able to look back to Dr. Spock's famous book on bringing up of children. It was known all over the world. Millions read it. It was a byword, Dr. Spock. And on the whole, he would go along the line of indulge your children. And let them have their way. Make life comfortable for them. Give way. Don't exert your authority. And then it was only years later that Dr. Spock said, I think I was wrong. I made a mistake. Well, that was about 47 million American lives later. Bit late to say that. How many problems must have resulted? Learn this foundationally from creation. Learn it realistically from the Bible. Learn it painfully from experience. Lastly, learn it positively from Jesus Christ. Children, obey your parents in everything. He did it. It can be done. Luke 2, verse 51, where we had our reading, tells us that he was obedient to his parents. It must have been hard. They understood little, as our reading explained to us. When he was there conversing with the teachers in the temple, his parents didn't understand a bit, but he went quietly back with them and was subject to them for all those years. What happened in those in-between years, between when Jesus Christ was 12 years of age and when he was 30 and began his public ministry? All those years cooped up with the family, was it hard? It must have been hard. He was obedient. And all the way through, he upheld the authority of parents. When Jesus found that some were, in the name of religion, saying, I'll dedicate that money that I would have liked to have spent on my parents, I'll dedicate it to the Lord's work, he expostulated with them. You have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. He wouldn't let it happen. That was in Mark chapter 7, verse 9. Christ learnt also what it was to grow slowly independent of his family while still giving full honor and respect. You remember how even at the moment of his death, he was making careful provision for his mother. Learn this from Christ himself. Be his disciple in this matter. However hard and however painful we may find it, whether we're parents or whether we're children, primarily. The fifth commandment is about the only one, it is the only one, we're unlikely to have to keep all our life. So we ought to make the most of our parents while they're around, if circumstances permit, while we have them. The odd letter, the keeping in touch, the listening to the advice of a parent, even if we can't always quite take it, those telephone calls, the occasional holiday, savoring their presence for as long as possible, giving them, as far as in us lies, a reason for them to be proud of us rather than ashamed of us, grateful for us rather than enduring of us. And then, fellow parents, we have to try and encourage these children for as long as we live. It's a lifetime thing, all our lives. Learning to take the hands off, little by little. And yet always being available for those crises, the needy moments, the difficult decisions. Never swamping our children by our own personalities or achievements, but letting them live their own lives and be themselves. Never obliterating their own precious identity, but seeing ourselves as custodians for God. We learn this foundationally from creation. We learn it realistically from the Bible. We learn it painfully from experience. We learn it positively from Jesus Christ, who calls us to follow him every day. I like the words that were spoken to a woman who became known in later life as the Maréchal. The Maréchal? You ever heard of the Maréchal? I never knew anything about her, but she was a great preacher, a woman preacher. She was daughter of General Booth of the Salvation Army, and she became a mighty preacher. And we read about her that when Katie, that was her name, was still a little girl, her mother would say to her, "Now, Katie, you are not here in this world for yourself. You have been sent for others. The world is waiting for you." That's an amazing sentence to send a little girl to bed with night after night. But look what it did to Katie. Was it right to do that? Maybe it was right. Certainly to encourage her. And there, Katie would turn the words over and over as she lay in bed, as she snuggled up with the sheets around her chin. Mother says the world is waiting for me. One can be overambitious in the wrong sense. Ambitious because you want your own pride to be satisfied. That's wrong. What we do long, surely, is that our lives and families, parenthood, whatever our calling is, that it should reflect something of the beauty and the unity of God's family. Obey. Don't provoke. It's a bit of each. And we all have responsibilities. What is yours? Would you give thought to that this evening as you go to rest tonight? What is your responsibility primarily to be? I think the text has something to say for all of us. Let's pray. Deliver us, Heavenly Father, from ever staying in the rut of what we consider to be failure and imperfection. Help us always to follow after Jesus Christ, to find strength in his inspiration. And this we pray for his name's sake. Amen.